A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 6 of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. I am your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio here in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm really excited to be bringing you this new season of shows coming to you on the first and third Wednesdays of every month. I have a great lineup of fascinating conversations with incredible musicians, songwriters, guitarists, steel guitarists, drummers, composers, who knows what else. I've been having an incredible time diving deep with these folks, and I know you're going to enjoy listening. Just a reminder that this year I've taken out the short song samples through the show, as things have gotten way more complicated as far as legal use of music goes, so I'll be making an accompanying Spotify playlist to each episode, which you'll find in the episode's show notes and at the website at makersandshakerspodcast.com. So anytime you hear this cute little slide guitar sound, you'll know there's a track to go along with it on the playlist. We have some new sponsors this year, but continue to be largely listener-supported. Your help in keeping the show going is always appreciated, and you can do it with a one-time donation or a Patreon subscription. Patreon is a monthly payment of your choice, and when you sign up for that, you get a bit of added content as well as an ad-free version of the show to listen to. If you don't feel like kicking in any dough, that's cool too, but you can help by subscribing for free on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or just spread the word by sharing the show, following us on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, and telling all your pals about it. You can get links to all this stuff, of course, at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Meanwhile, many thanks to our sponsors this season. Please check them out and let them know that I sent you. They are Isotope, Ear Trumpet Labs, Union Tube and Transistor, Black Mountain Picks, and Spectra 1964. Hey there, folks and music nerds. Welcome back to Season 6 of the show. This is episode number 134. We've got a really cool guest here this week, something a little different, but very exciting nonetheless, a film and television composer who I've known for a long time and done a fair chunk of work with over the years, Patrick Caird. So things are winding down for the year around here. It's been a pretty busy fall, and I'm quite thankful for that and all the people that I've had a chance to work with and make music with over the last year as things sort of tried to come back to normal. In retrospect, I gotta say this has also been one of the toughest years to make things work as a musician. On some levels, things are firing on all cylinders, but honestly, there's also another side to things that you don't hear about as much. Traveling's become way more expensive, as we all know, and complicated, which we all know. And that's impacted gigs and also impacted people who are thinking about traveling to make records. So it's had an impact on my studio life for sure as a recording person and as a side person in the studio. As a solo artist trying to gig and tour, things have become extremely difficult, like crazy. I'm not really going to get into it all here, but just to say if you're struggling out there as a musician, it's definitely not an isolated thing. And I'm looking forward to getting into some new things in 2023 and see what that next year brings to us. But anyway, at the same time, it's lovely to be here in Nashville and making music with people. So yay for that. So my guest this week is someone I've known for a long time, and he's done some really incredible work in the film and television world. And some of his credits include shows like The Dead Zone, The Collector, The Imperfects, The Order, Outer Limits, not to mention a ton of stuff for the Hallmark Channel, which is really cool. I got to know Pat. I call him Pat. You should maybe call him Patrick if you're talking to him in a professional way. I don't know. I call him Pat. He's my buddy. I got to know him about 22 or 3 years ago, I guess, which seems crazy to me, but that's when it was. And at the time, he was working on this animated show for Comedy Central called Ed, Edd and Eddy. And he was doing that with our mutual great friend, Sean Pierce. And that show was insane, both the show itself, which was insane, but the music was really spectacular. And I've never heard or seen anything like it since. And the way that it happened was Pat would write almost wall-to-wall music for the score of the show every week and arrange it for a really cool band that was mostly horn players with a rhythm section. It was kind of like trashy small/big band kind of stuff. And then he'd bring in the entire band and they'd set up and read the score down, which was handwritten by Pat every week. So I think it was every Monday, might have been every Tuesday, they'd go in, everybody, go into the studio in Vancouver, and he'd have all this music handwritten, which is so nuts. Like, there's so much music to write. And he was usually writing more as they had started. He was still writing cues. But anyway, within a couple of hours, they'd knock out these incredible arrangements that were really fun and whimsical and nutty. And it was so cool to see. I just saw it because I was friends with those guys, and I sat in a couple times and watched the whole thing go down, and it was incredible. The show, Ed and Eddie, was animated by a guy named Danny Antonucci, who is well known for his role in these sick and twisted animation film festivals that used to happen all the time around Vancouver and elsewhere. He had a character called Lupo the Butcher, and then a series on MTV called The Grunts, and then that led to Ed and Eddie. Anyway, at one point, one of the Eds on the show started to play steel guitar for no apparent reason, and I got asked to play that instrument for the show, which I did, and that little clip got to be known as 88 Fingers Edward and has become something of a weird cult classic. And if you'd like to hear about that with another interview that I did with Pat about a year ago, you can find it on my YouTube channel. And if you just search for 88 Fingers Edward on YouTube, you'll find it. It's pretty funny. Anyway, Pat's an amazing musician, and I thought it would be cool to hear a bit about how that side of things works, composing for film and TV, especially in the Netflix age, just how it all goes down. It's not something I know that much about, and I haven't done too much composing specifically for TV like this. I've done a little bit, but not too much. So I thought it'd be cool to hear from somebody who does it all the time. You can find info on Patrick Caird and all his projects at patrickcaird.com. That's Patrick with a C at the end, no K. Caird, C-A-I-R-D.com. Before we get going here, I'd just like to shout out to some folks who made donations or signed up to the Patreon over the last couple weeks. It's been a few people. Thanks, everybody. John Barnum, Mark Giacoponi. This one I'm going to blow it. Morten Vase Villert. I'm guessing he's Dutch, and I'm guessing I blew it, but that's how I'm going to say it. Dan Berman, Sean Fetter, and Ann Weaver. Thank you so much, you guys. I really appreciate it. And don't forget, we are giving away a Union Tube and Transistor C-Verb reverb pedal at the end of this season to a random Patreon subscriber. So if you become one, you will be entered automatically. And we also have some new merch for the show, coffee mugs and hoodies and a couple new t-shirts. You can get them over at the podcast website merch page. So that's makersandshakerspodcast.com. There's a merch page. Check them out. And finally, just wanted to let you know that the Hen House Hang this year is going to be September 25th to 28th. And it'll be an amazing 4 days of learning about how the studio works and how songs are recorded. You can get the scoop on that at stevedawson.ca. The Hen House Hang. Come on down. There's currently, I think, 4 or 5 spots left only. So get in there. All right, let's get down to it. Enjoy my conversation with Patrick Caird.
So we're going to talk about the fascinating me.
Let's do it. Let's just launch in. So, you know, a big part of what I would love to talk to you about is how you've kind of transitioned your career. I mean, this is going back a long time, but basically from being like a live guy into being a film guy, essentially. And I know you still play, although nothing like you used to. You were really road dogging it for years there, right?
Yeah.
So, but before we do that, maybe you could tell me some of your latest projects, because we haven't really caught up in that regard. We've talked about other stuff, but as far as like what you've been doing musically in the last 3, 4, 5 years, I'm not totally sure. So maybe you could just kind of catch me up on some of the latest projects that you're doing.
Sure. I just finished a Netflix series called The Imperfects, 10 episodes. It's a supernatural thing. For the last 3 or 4 years, I've sort of been into this groove with a friend of mine who's doing these supernatural ghost story crazy shows. Before this, it was a show called The Order, which ran for 2 seasons on Netflix and was really quite popular. And before that, it was a show called Ghost Wars, which was also a blast. And so I kind of got into this thing with this buddy of mine who's a producer, and
he did all those shows, the same guy?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was on all 3 of those shows. And he created, did he create The Order? I think he created The Order, and he may have, and he co-created The Imperfects. And they're all fun. I mean, they're all like, certainly the Order and The Imperfects are like beautiful young people with, you know, supernatural problems. You know, every now and then I turn into a werewolf.
Right.
Yeah, you know, so. And it's fun to work with him. And Netflix is good, you know, because you just kind of like put your head down and make shows. And it's great.
Tell me a little bit about that process. Like the whole, you've kind of seen the birth of Netflix. You've been through like the tail end of life pre-streaming. And then now there's all this streaming where like, it just seems like content is being produced like just left, right, and center. And I'd imagine that things have changed a lot in that way, but how's the actual day-to-day working of being a composer on a strictly Netflix show work for you?
Oh, it's great. It's great. I mean, certainly in the early days of Netflix was kind of like they saw themselves as an IT company, you know, like they delivered product and they figured out how to sell it. And that was their sort of niche. And, and they left the creative, not entirely, but they said, you guys make the stuff and we get it on out to the viewers. You know, we're the conduit to do that. We sell it.
Okay.
So there was a lot of focus on sort of letting the creatives be creative and doing their thing. And Netflix had a lot of belief in the people that they were working in. And that's, I think, how they managed to build up their, you know, market share is, as you say, it's content. No,
yeah.
They just keep pushing it in. And over the last couple of years, I think certainly during the COVID, things kind of shifted because everything got shut down. And then they started trying to rebuild the system and getting more involved and creative, not interferingly, but just having ideas. For example, this show that we're on now is kind of like we were on the order and the executives at Netflix said to my friend, Dennis Heaton, said, well, do you want to do another show? And he goes, okay. And
I love it.
I go, how about a mad scientist? And Dennis goes, great. You know, so off they go, you know.
Wow.
So that's pretty cool. And an interesting thing. I mean, as you know, streaming has had some pretty negative effects on our income as musicians and royalties.
Can you explain how that's affected things? Like, I understand it from a musician side, not with Netflix, obviously, but with streaming services. But for you as a composer, can you tell me how that has affected things for you? Like, as far as, you know, how it works with back end stuff versus getting paid up front and if it's simpler or more complicated, like I don't really know what the scoop is with all that stuff now.
When streaming first hit, I noticed a pretty substantial drop in my royalties for, you know, performance rights royalties by a factor of 10.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
You know, so what used to be a pretty nice passive income pretty much just disappeared completely.
So why is that? Cause it's not like the shows aren't getting played. So it's just collected and distributed in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there's a bunch of different philosophies and theories about it, and it gets kind of contentious. When you look at it, like when you go out on a network or on a radio station, for example, they have X number of listeners that they're pretty confident that they have, and they have a sales model. They're selling time to advertisers based on their audience, which would be, I don't know, 500,000 people in a big city or 1 million people in a bigger city kind of thing. And they know that those people are listening to the radio, and that's, they've got an audience of 1 million people. So they go, our time is worth X per 15 seconds, you know?
Okay.
But with streaming, and you may not always have all of those million people listening to your ad.
Right.
But there's a reasonable presumption that a lot of them will be. And if you've got a small radio station that gets like 150,000 listeners, you know, the advertising budget would be commensurate with that. It would, you know, you'd spend less per 15 second block. With streaming, it's individual streams. So you might, they know how many people have watched their show. They even know when they stopped watching it and if they watched from one episode to the next. With the streamers, it's all about, from what I'm understanding, it's all about getting people to stay engaged with the platform.
Yep, I understand that.
You know, you may have a show that a million people are watching over time, but it's not like the assumption that a million people will have an opportunity to watch it the way old school broadcast royalties worked.
Right.
So I understand the math around that.
Yeah.
But there is this sort of problem that it's all happening behind the curtain. All the information is not, it's proprietary, right?
What kind of information do you get, like, as a composer? Do you know what kind of numbers of people are watching the shows or anything? Or you're just, like, out of the loop?
No, it's just a line item on my SOCAN statement.
Wow.
And, you know, a couple of zeros got knocked off of it.
That sucks.
Yeah, really. You know, so that, but to be, also to be fair, I mean, The Order was a pretty big show.
Yeah.
And I did start to see over the course of the run of the show, we did two seasons, the royalties started to tick up.
Okay.
And that was great. But ironically, even though it was getting more, you know, penetration into the market, it wasn't performing the way the algorithms required it to perform to satisfy the Netflix mandate.
So they axed it.
So they canned it. And it was a very popular show. Huh. But it's not about being popular. It's about the behavior of the viewers.
Weird.
This is my, you know, this is the only way I can figure it out. And I've had this conversation a few times with different producers who are still also scratching their heads going, we have no idea, you know. But I do notice that used to be that, you know, you'd really have to fuck up your first season to not get a second season because, you know, you do your front load, you know, it's expensive to get a show up. Once it's up, you can run it out. Yep. But I've been noticing just sort of anecdotally, looking at the little bit of media news that I look at, Netflix is canning shows in the first season now. So that's a slightly different behavior.
And like not even seeing them through the first season or just like saying at the end of the season, this is it.
You'll do the whole show and then it'll hit. And usually in the first 3 or 4 weeks, they'll say, okay, let's keep it going, you know?
Right.
Cause you know, it takes months to get 10 shows written and shot and then fucking at least an hour or two to get them composed.
So you've noticed a big drop in the back end royalties. What about in the upfront stuff? Like does Netflix, like when you work on a Netflix show, are you getting paid an upfront amount that's similar to what you would have been paid like back 15 years ago for doing a TV show, or is it way less, or what's that
look like? It's similar. It's similar-ish.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, there's been such downward pressure on that, you know, because everyone now is a composer.
Right.
And I don't blame them. It's a great way to spend your time. But, you know, there's a lot of downward pressure on fees and also the expectations are different. And so that's been going on for a long time.
Right.
You hoped that the show would be a hit and you would wind up with some residual income, or technically it's not residuals, it's royalties, which are different. But anyhow, so it's things are changing so quickly.
Yeah.
I don't really do a lot of the socials, you know, I'm not engaging that way. I've heard that some people, I don't know how true this is, but I've heard that some people use their followers as a bargaining chip, you know, like.
Right. Oh, I've got
400,000 followers. Yeah. You know, I'm going to bring eyes to your show. You need to compensate me accordingly. Like, I'm quite sure that's the way it goes with, you know, the TikTok people and the YouTube people. In fact,
that sounds like a really frustrating game for a composer to be involved in.
Yes. And then you see guys that put time into it, you know, and they do beautiful, like Bear McCreary is fantastic, you know, and Trevor Morris does a lot of social media stuff. There's a lot of guys that have created really interesting.
Well, those guys are also doing massive shows and they may well have a team that just does that for them, right?
They've got lots of folks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, I personally don't care for that style of working. But I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I mean, I'm not judging some guy because he's got two or three people like doing the night shift for him and taking care of business. And
right.
Ultimately he's the decider. He's the guy that's making those final decisions. If this is worthy of, you know, if it's representational of what he's doing.
Yeah.
And it's an odd thing, you know, man, I've often wondered about this. I've lost a gig, couple of gigs, and you never know if you've lost a gig because you were the guy and then someone came in, but you know, you have a feeling about stuff you're pitching on. And there's been a couple of times where I thought that I was, we're close to closing. And then at the last minute, it disappears, goes to someone else. And it, on two specific occasions, that someone else was a guy that was doing 10 series already.
Oh my God.
And I'm thinking, you know, and the last time the producer, one of my producer friends on the inside, called me to say that I wasn't going to do the job. And I said, oh, well, that's too bad. That's really disappointing. Do you mind if I ask who got it? And he told me.
Yeah.
And he goes, you know, so-and-so's doing the job, but I wish it was you. And I said, well, you'll wish it was him too, because he's doing 10 shows.
Right, right. You know?
So just so people understand, like, this is a thing that has been going on for a long time where a composer will get a job, but kind of like farm out a lot of the work to other people and then sort of bring it under his own umbrella, right? That's sort of what you're referring to.
Yeah, I think that's the worst description of it. I think most of these guys are doing the, you know, they'll do the meeting, they'll get the job, they'll get the concept, they'll, you know, they'll work through that whole thing, which is a huge amount of work.
Yeah.
They'll get the sound, they'll get the themes, they'll do all that sort of thing. Then once that template's up in place, you can pretty confidently, you know, say we're using this theme here and that thing there, and here's the tempo, and I want to stop, but, you know, go through the spot. A lot of that's all in the spotting. And then have their people sort of finish it. And then, you know, it's almost like the Andy Warhol system, you know,
right. Yeah.
Not quite that, you know, factory-ish, but, you know, so you set the tone of the show. And the guy that I'm thinking of, he does a bunch of different things, obviously, and different styles for each one, you know, so he's got great scope and he's obviously very talented, and, you know, he's just churning the stuff out with the help of people that he's teaching how to make it right. So there's pluses and minuses to both of it. And I'm certainly not going to talk disparagingly about that system. It's just not the system that attracts me at all. You know,
you don't have 30 mini Pat Carrads working behind the sofa over there.
I don't. But I mean, when I was busy working on three shows, more than three shows at a time, there would be cues where it didn't require me to do that. You know, like there'd be something they had tempted with some pop tune or other, and you know, I was busy doing the score for the whatever, and I would hire guys that I knew that were excellent, that had the skills, and I'd say, this is the tune that they want it to sound like, here's our palette, you know, let her rip, you know. Yeah. But if it was, I always felt kind of bad about taking responsibility for someone else's cue. On the times that happened, you're sitting in the mix and the producer looks over at you with tears in their eyes and saying, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever heard. And you go, yeah, my buddy wrote it, actually. So I never felt good to me. So I just didn't like doing it.
Yeah, I get it. You mentioned the pitching process. Can you walk me through that? So like, obviously, like for you to get a gig, there's one way where it happens where there's a producer that you've worked with and they know you and they know what kind of work you do. And that probably just happens kind of organically. But when there's a show that you hear about that I assume like through a manager or something like that, what does that actually mean when you pitch for a show? Like, do you get visual cues and write sample cues and all that?
Sure. They do that.
Like these, I'm talking about these days in the Netflix streaming world. How does that work? When you're pitching for something where you don't have an in?
Well, you know, it's very seldom that comes to fruition.
Oh, okay.
You know, over the years, I've definitely, you know, pitched my reel on a show. Oh, there's a show, blah, blah, blah. It's sort of similar to another show you've done. Occasionally, someone that I don't know has said, can we hear some stuff from Pat Caird, you know? But normally, there's some kind of organic connection to the project. And then things, you know, inside of that, there's a hierarchy of power, you know, and
yeah,
if your guy is powerful enough, you know, he can bring you in. And if he's already pulled a couple of, you know, wins, he's going to have to give some away. And sometimes you're the guy that gets given away, you know? And so,
right.
So there's all these things going on, but ultimately I think everyone's just trying to make the best show possible, you know, and there's lots of guys that are capable of doing what I do. And it's just the relationship that people want the comfort.
Well, it's the same with music, for sure. It's the exact same thing where 9 times out of 10, it's all through somebody you know or somebody you've worked with in a different capacity, for sure.
Yeah.
So is that something where it's helpful to be in Los Angeles for that reason, or not so much anymore? Like, you've sort of forged those connections and relationships and you don't feel like you need to be there anymore, or is that an active part of it where you kind of feel like you need to make an appearance down there and see some peeps?
Well, you know, I lived there for 15 years and loved every breath of it. And
I loved your place. You had the best place.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
You know, but that changed too near the end. I mean, that whole neighborhood, Laurel Canyon and the hills there, became very desirable. Before, it was, no one wanted to live up there because it was, you know, up in
it's
the
hard
hill.
To get to.
And scary and weird. And yeah. And now everyone wants to live there. And I'm telling you, man, for 7 years, there was construction across the street from us. And
oh my God.
Every morning at 6, the cars would pull up and the doors would slam. And, you know, the workers would be talking outside your window, your bedroom window. And you're just kind of like, brother, you got to, like, can you keep it down? And they were very apologetic, but they were at work, you know, their day had started. And anyway, that neighborhood really changed. Back to what you were asking about being in Los Angeles, it's not going to hurt your career, that's for sure. And you get to meet people, and you get to meet the best people. Like, not the best people, they're the best people, but you get to meet the top engineers and the top musicians and the top orchestrators and these guys. That I love that city. I remember the first time I went there, and I was sitting in a restaurant, don't even remember where, somewhere in Hollywood, and every conversation around me was the business, was TV or movies. And I went, I want to live here.
Yeah.
This is actually what I care about. I don't care about whatever the hell you're talking about in, you know, in Vancouver or whatever. I mean, I don't want to be too disparaging about it, but I just love the fact that everyone is in the business.
You know? Right. Yeah. That's how I feel here in Nashville too.
Oh, it's another great place. You know, when I was there, you know, a couple of years ago, I just loved it. Everyone was a player and music was important to, like, normal people walking down the street. Anyhow, there's a lot of bonuses to being in Los Angeles. And part of it is the actual community of composers and musicians.
Right.
There's one in Toronto. There's no question. There's a community there. And there's one in Vancouver as well. But it's just massive. And not only that, but they're the best guys. I mean, when I first got to LA, I joined the Society of Composers and Lyricists and another organization called ASMAC, the American Society of Music Arrangers and Composers. These are weekly or monthly meetings, depending on what's going on, with the guys that make TV and movies. Like, you know, they've worked their whole life and now they're old and they're retired, not all of them. And, you know, I met Johnny fucking Mandel at these things. I mean,
amazing.
Christ. You know, and I saw Claire Fisher play, and I, you know, and I talked to Bill Holman, and everyone was so friendly and so supportive. And it's like, I remember I went to an SCL meeting and I was doing a...
What's SCL?
Society of Composers and Lyricists.
Okay.
And I was writing the score for a dance theater production in Toronto with a live band, a 9-piece band on stage, sort of basically the... Histoire de Soldat Stravinsky 8-piece with an added flute. And it was based on Peter and the Wolf and blah, 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 blah. It was an hour, 70-minute long piece. And it was pretty much continuous music. And I'm writing this piece and I'm thinking, because, you know, I mean, I showed you the charts last time. I usually write everything by hand. I'm thinking, there's no way I'm going to write this by hand. I mean, it's going to take forever. And I'm going to go through more whiteout than there's on the planet, you know? So I'm at one of these SCL meetings and I meet this guy named Charles Fernandez, just a sweetheart. And I go, oh man, do you know anything about Sibelius? And he goes, yeah, I kind of know everything about Sibelius. And I go, well, can I pay you for some lessons or something? He says, no, you can't, but I'll get together with you at lunch and I'll show you what's going on. So we got together at a restaurant in the Beverly Center and with our laptops, you know, sitting there and he showed me how to, you know, get better at, I knew it a little bit, but he showed me how he worked it. And it was a totally different method from the way I was doing it, way more efficient because he'd been doing it forever.
Yep.
And then he said, look, call me anytime if you have a problem. And I'd call him at 11 at night. And he'd go, yeah, yeah, I just do that. It's
amazing.
Command L. You know? Right. So anyway, there's that infrastructure there. And again, it's the kind of place where you can go and sit down and have a very in-depth conversation about, you know, about an arrangement on a tune and the string parts, you know. Also, ASMAC, an amazing, they do it all now online, and it's worth looking into if you're curious at all about that stuff. They would have these workshops where you know, on Saturdays once a month or every 6 weeks or so, you'd go out to a college in the Valley and sit there, and they would, you know, Bob Mincer did one. They were really incredible. It's a great community. If you like music and movies, you kind of have to be there. You don't have to, but it's a great place to go and do it. As far as does it help your career? I mean, I did do some local work when I was in the States, but most of my main jobs were still from my Canadian clients and friends like that.
Interesting.
Were across the line. I mean, I did quite a few Hallmark movies too, which I loved.
Yeah.
And the Hallmark office was like 3 miles from my house. So
oh, really?
I could just pop by and talk to the music supervisor, the head of music there, and do meetings there. I really enjoyed it. I love the Hallmark stuff. It's fantastic.
Can you take a series, like say, whether it's The Imperfects or another one that you've enjoyed doing lately, and just like kind of walk me through how you approach doing an episode and what it actually is like as far as what you get visually? Do you get the completed episode? What do you get from the director as far as like how hands-on are they? Like, I guess pick a show and tell me how hands-on they are and what your approach is to composing and then how it actually goes down these days.
Yeah, okay. So typically there's that whole brainstorming session that happens at the beginning of the show where you're talking about ideas, and I'll do mock-ups and demos of stuff, not even necessarily to picture. And in fact, there was one show when I was sort of pitching on a show where I hired a string quartet to come in and play some music for me because I couldn't get the samples to do what I wanted them to do. And they were also, I'd heard them at the Disney Hall. And I say, hey, I'm doing a thing. Would you mind doing a demo? And they said, oh, we'd love to. We'll be right over. Oh, wow. Okay. And it's just a killer string quartet. And so it definitely made me sound better. And I got the gig. But so you do all of that sort of like figuring out what it is ahead of time. And then once you're in production, there'll be, it's called a temp score. You've probably heard of it. Where they take music from other stuff and sometimes your own music and put it in, sort of slug it in, like we want music here, we want it here, blah, blah, blah. And the picture editor is responsible a lot for how that goes, but also the showrunner, who's sort of the big boss.
The runner is the guy that sort of oversees the entire thing as a whole, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
He's not directing individual episodes, or he is sometimes?
Sometimes he does, or she does. And sometimes they're the head writer, on a show for the creator.
Yeah.
But they're basically running the show, hence the title showrunner.
Okay.
And so everything goes through them. And they also are all the shit that comes down hits them, you know.
Okay.
So I'm glad I have one in front of me. You know?
Right.
And very often I've been in situations where there's been notes that have come down and they've elected not to share that note with me because, number one, creatively they didn't agree with it, and number two, maybe it wasn't something that would benefit, you know, because you kind of have to have a pretty strong thick skin. But people can say some pretty mean stuff,
really
unknowingly, you know, like, this is the worst thing I've ever heard. Oh, what is this guy thinking?
You know? Like that'll be actually in the show notes.
Well,
potentially
you get protected from that usually by a good showrunner or a producer that sort of insulates you from it, because he understands that we're all, you know, we're creatives. But if it's not going to be constructive, if it's a criticism that isn't going to push the ball forward, you know,
okay.
Then there's no point in bringing it up. If it's chronic, if you keep continue to do the, you know, like there's this one cue and someone will say, this is the worst thing I've ever heard. Yeah. The rest of it, they're going, I love this part. This keep, the more, you know, so you realize that it's all kind of on a sliding scale. You never want to hear, this is the worst thing, but you also don't want to hear, you don't want to miss that someone's unhappy with what you're doing because you want to be able to make a change in
right,
real time.
Right.
Anyway, so back to the process. So you'll get generally, you'll get a what's called a fine cut.
Okay.
Which means it is not going to change, but it always changes, man.
It does.
And so, well, no, a locked cut is not going to change. A fine cut is like going to be something like this. And, okay, you know, it'll be 45 minutes long or whatever, to whatever time they need it to be. Sometimes it'll be long and you know that you'll be cutting stuff down. Sometimes it'll be short, mm-hmm, whatever. And then it's got the temp score in there and then you'll spot it. The spotting session is where you pick the spots where the music goes. But more importantly,
like the actual, like from 46 seconds to a minute 46, you're going to have a thing, a cue. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, they'll generally have a temp in there.
Yeah.
Something, you know, and the temp is sometimes, you know, sometimes you'll get to pay no attention to the temp. It's just a placeholder.
Right.
Or other times they'll go, I like the pace of this. I like the, I like the sparseness. I like the busyness. I like the bigness. I like the smallness, you know, and you get, so you start in this kind of language.
Yeah.
Usually, my big question in these sessions is if there's a cue going on and I'll turn to the showrunner and I'll say, what do we want to feel here? What am I adding? You know, we've got it written. We've got it shot. We can see what it is. We can hear what they're saying. Mm-hmm. Music is kind of like your last chance for subtext.
Yeah.
It's also, you know, you can reinforce stuff. You can send a false, you know, you can send them off in the wrong direction. You can surprise them. You can make them sadder. You can make them happier. You know, this is the things that music can do. And very often, if it's already on the screen, I lobby to get out of the way and let it play, you know, mm-hmm, not because it's less work for me, but because it always, when I'm watching something and I'm getting the feels and then I hear the music cue come in, I go, don't kill me, please. You know, you know, unless it's Maurice Jarre, I don't want to fucking hear music right now. You know?
Right, right.
I got the music already going, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, there's certain expectations, and also a show will set a tone. And so you want to be consistent with the tone of the show. So, yeah, so you go through, you spot it. And then I'm left to my own devices, really. I mean, I've come up in all the shows, you come up with general themes and certainly a template, a palette of sounds.
A theme, a general theme that you're going to use, whether it's the main theme or whether it's a theme that'll be recurring through the show. Do you run those all by the runner as you go?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And you pointed out, you know, some shows are very sort of leitmotif, you know, you've got a theme for him and a theme for her and a theme for this and a theme for that. And you play it like that was, the order was very much that way.
Okay.
There was a lot of themes for that. Ghost Wars was less so. And the Hallmark stuff, what I love to do is write a melody for our heroine, basically, and then occasionally a counter melody or bridge, you know, for our man, the love interest, and then just to mix, you know, like a mix and match. And I've done, I don't know, a dozen Christmas movies, and I love the Christmas stuff because it's like you take those two themes and add Christmas, you know, like sprinkle snowflake on top. It writes itself.
Get some good jingle bell tracks in there and you're off to the races.
And I really like it.
So when you're composing the themes, are you, what's your tool? What are you composing on?
Piano, keyboard, usually.
Always. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you assign sounds to it. But I mean, it's the melody and the harmonies. You know, I've always had this kind of philosophy that the melody tells the story and the harmony tells the feeling, you know? And so, you know, you've got this melody line going and, okay, we're going through time and this is what it's happening. But, you know, you harmonize it differently and it becomes a different journey, you know?
And
then there's also texture and timbre and orchestration and all those other parts that add to it, but just in very basic terms, those are the sort of things which, you know, I have a tendency to be attracted to complex harmonies, probably because of my jazz background. And I've learned over time that you can go too far in that direction. And sometimes less is way, way, way more. And if you can say it with three notes, say it with three notes, you know. Mm-hmm.
But that's a good lesson.
Making the best. Oh, man, you're telling me. It's funny because you mentioned playing. I mean, I haven't played for 20 years, but I did go out and play a gig with the blues band that I toured with for 15 years in September. It's literally the first gig I've done since 2000.
How's the embouchure?
Well, that's funny you should say. Okay, I'll give you this story. It's really kind of sweet. So I'm here on Salt Spring, and there was a bunch of people here in the house and everything, and then they all went back to their homes, and I'm alone on Salt Spring, and you know, I've got my piano downstairs, and I don't have any work at the moment, and so I thought, oh, I'll take out the horn and see what that feels like. It had literally been 2 or 3 years since I touched it.
Yeah.
So I take it out and I start to and I go, oh yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. This might not go as well as I thought it would. And that week, like a couple days later, I get a phone call out of the blue from the leader of the band that I played with 20 years ago saying
Powder Blues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tom goes, Pat, Powder's got a gig. You're on the band. And I go, what? And he goes, Powder's got a gig. You're on the band. And I go, Tom, I haven't played for 20 years. He goes, I don't fucking care. You don't have to play. Just show up, bring your horn, play two notes. It'll be better than anybody. And I go, well, Tom, I'm not going to do that. When is it? He goes, and this was in, this would have been the end of July. And he goes, okay. September 5th in Calgary. And I go, oh, that's about 6 weeks away. No, I'm not going to. I think for a while he goes, Clark's on the band. Kalanja's on the band. Blah, 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 blah. All the guys I used to play with. And he goes, come on, you got to do it. And I go, okay, I'll say I'm going to do it, but I reserve the right to pull out at the last minute. He goes, yeah, just like sex life. And he goes, so I take this fucking gig and then I realized that if I'm going to stand on stage for 90 minutes, I'm going to have to build some face back here. You know, like that's hard to play the saxophone for 90
I'll
minutes.
Say.
And you know, it's hard to play any instrument, like playing an instrument, you're an athlete. And, you know, I haven't walked around the block. I've sit in this chair, you know? So I start practicing the saxophone every day for 6 weeks. And by the time the gig came along, I made it through the 90 minute set. And it was really fun. And I had a great time. And one of the things that I promised myself was that I wasn't going to show off and I wasn't going to try to do fancy stuff, which I'd had a tendency to do when I was a player. And I was just going to play what I heard. And if I didn't hear anything, I wasn't going to play. And when we hit the bandstand, I was nervous and feeling weird and you know, you're disoriented. And it was an outdoor gig in the middle of a football field on the back of a flatbed stage.
You know? Oh my God.
Worst possible condition in the world, you know? And I felt a little iffy for the first tune or two. And then I kind of went, you know what? Just you're with your buddies and it's a beautiful night. And you know, they've got single malt scotch in the band room. Enjoy yourself. And I did. And it was really, really fun.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
The road, however, hasn't changed.
No, it's the same set of shit after another.
Just relentless crap. And you know, they've made flying in an airplane the least sexy thing in the world.
Oh, it's the worst.
Oh,
it's so uncomfortable and so stressful for me, especially because I'm usually trying to get shit on the plane.
Me too, right? My horn. You know, I go, this thing's worth a lot of money. You're not putting it under there.
Yeah.
Didn't you get an instrument smashed to hell one time?
I did, yeah. It's over there, yeah.
Well, and you know, you saxophones, even though they're made out of metal, they bend really easily.
Okay, I do want to ask you about some of your road dog days, but before we get there, just going back to the show for a minute. So if you've spotted it, you've composed it roughly, I guess, all on keyboard, it's all Are you all using samples, or are you bringing in musicians and going into studios these days as well?
Oh, well, I was going to say, I got derailed there. A lot of my stuff is sort of MIDI orchestra and has been for ages, with a little bit of synth and percussion, and then live players whenever possible. But the budgets have...
Would you say pretty much across the board, when you get a gig these days, it's just going to be you composing with MIDI?
Yes, but to be clear, on with these producers that I'm working with the Netflix, they always sort of have a little money set aside for live players if I need it, or if it comes up. They're very they encourage that. So they understand the value add of a real player in the right situation, you know. But you can't get an orchestra. I mean, it's none of that. That's not going to happen. But one beautiful instrument playing a beautiful melody.
So is that something you do, if possible, would be to do like an orchestral MIDI score and then bring in a real violin player to play a melody or something? Okay, cool.
Done it a lot, you know. Yeah. Or even, you know, I don't really play the guitar. I own a bunch of them, you know, I play at them. but I call myself a guitar owner. You know, if there's a guitar part, I'll hire someone to play it, because, you know, without exception, you get a great musician to play your music and you're going to sound better.
You know? Right.
They're going to make you sound great, you know, and it's sort of that stroke of genius that, you make me sound wonderful.
This show is brought to you by the good folks at iZotope, who make incredible plug-in software for any music or dialogue recording situation. Among other things, they make a very unique suite of software called RX, which you can use to surgically repair almost any kind of issue in a recording. Whether it's removing electrical hum, unwanted noise, vocal plosives, or almost anything you can throw at it. I use iZotope RX on every mix in one way or another, and I love that I can get in there on guitar tracks that I'm doing and running through my crazy old tube amps and get rid of the hum and noise without affecting the actual tone of the guitar. You can buy their plugins outright or get a subscription to keep up to date on all their latest versions. Right now, they're offering listeners a 10% discount on any of their plugins when you use the code SOULPOD10 at checkout. So head on over to iZotope.com/SOULPOD, and you'll see the links right there to get the discount or an extended 30-day trial of their subscription service of Music Production Suite Pro. We're also brought to you this season by Black Mountain Picks. These are unique spring-loaded thumb picks that are super comfortable and adaptable. I've been using them for a couple of years now, and I absolutely love them. They come in medium gauge, heavy gauge, jazz-tipped, left-handed, and with regular or extra-tight spring tension. Check them out at blackmountainpicks.com. Thanks to our other sponsor, Union Tube and Transistor. They're known for guitar effects pedals with a focus on quality and simplicity. They build durable, repairable products that sound amazing, both on stage and in the studio. I use their Sonebender fuzz pedal, the Moore pedal, and the Swindle overdrive pedal all the time in sessions and live on stage. You can find them at uniontone.com. And thanks to Spectra 1964. For over 50 years, Spectra 1964 has established a reputation of creating some of the most innovative recording equipment on the market today. From the legendary V610, C610, and 611 comp limiter units to the new 500 series Lunchbox mic pres and EQs, Spectra 1964 continues the legacy of providing incredible recording products for the home or professional studio. Check them out at spectra1964.com. And finally, the Hen House Hang. It's a four-day immersive recording experience right here with me at the Hen House Studio in East Nashville on September 19 to 22, 2022. Join us for a musical learning experience like no other. We'll put you up in a groovy hotel, feed you some glorious food, show you the ropes of recording roots and Americana music by bringing you in on a real session with real musicians working on real songs from the ground up. You can get all the info on that at stevedawson.ca. Just follow the links on the front page to the Hen House Hang. All right then, let's get back to the show. So you take your score that you've basically put in place, you've put it where they want it, and then... what, you submit the entire thing as a whole to the runner for him to go through?
That's the process that I did on this last series. I would hold everything back once we got into it. For the first few, you kind of want to make sure you're on track. And if there's any course correction, you don't want to have written 30 minutes of music and then have to go page one everything, which seldom happens. But, you know, once you're up and running and things have been sort of established and you're comfortable, I would write the entire show. And then I would send videos of that to the showrunner, who would then make notes to me hit this harder, change that here. I need this. This is sounding sad. I want it to be scary, or, mm-hmm. you know, I want it to be more surprise here, or I need more energy in this. And so you go and you do that, or, you know, and also to some of the comments are, this is fantastic. More of this, you know, and mm-hmm. I love this theme. Maybe we can come back to it later. You know, that sort of thing. You keep track of all that stuff.
How long does it take you to get to that point, roughly?
In terms of?
Like actual work to compose the entire episode in its first draft.
Well, I
mean, I know it would depend, but just say it was on the last one that you worked on. How long would you spend on an episode?
I hope to, you know, I aim to write 3 to 5 minutes, write, perform, produce, deliver 3 to 5 minutes of finished music a day.
Okay.
So if I've got 20 minutes of it, that's going to be 7 days of work. Well, 6 to 7.
Yeah.
You know, I always, when I'm scheduling my time out, I estimate low in terms of output, because then if you get ahead of yourself, that's great. And also my work, you know, my ideal work method is to get up very early, 4:35 in the morning.
Yeah.
And work till 5 at night. 5, shut her down, go to Monsoon.
Yeah. I wish.
But, you know, and then I'll do night shifts if I'm up against a deadline or something. And I haven't had to do an all-nighter in years, but in the old days, you know, that would happen.
Okay, so you get your notes from the runner or the director or whoever.
So the showrunner.
You make your revisions, mm-hmm. and then is there still back and forth and back and forth, and it just keeps going until you fine-tune it all?
It can. Generally, you know, once you're into the show, everything's pretty much, everyone's happy with what's going on. And even though the score does evolve and mm-hmm. things change, for example, in The Order, we started because they were young people and it was a college campus and there was this and that, but there was also scary monsters and horror aspects. We felt that we wanted to have sort of a modern touch to it that, you know, some samples and some drum loops and some synths added into this palette. But as the show progressed over the 20 episodes that we did, it pushed more and more into an orchestral operatic kind of thing. It felt it wanted. So it became more like opera orchestra with percussion. And the synth stuff kind of took a back seat.
Okay.
And the loops disappeared pretty much entirely. So
that really evolved.
It did evolve. And it was the right call. I mean, and the show changed too. The look of the show remained the same, but I mean, just the way it got played, it got more melodramatic and more kind of, you know, lurid and inky and beautiful.
And then when the score is essentially signed off on, you just hand it over to the sound mixer who's going to mix in the dialogue and the music. That's out of your hands. You don't get involved in any of that, like, overall mixing process, do you?
Well, this normally, no. Well, normally, yeah, it's 50-50. A lot of times they don't want to see a composer on the mixing stage because he's just going to say, turn up the music. So they figure that out.
Right.
But on this one, they did request that I was at every mix, and which I was happy to do because I'm...
Why?
They just wanted me to be there in case they wanted to make any changes at the last minute. Or I also think I enjoy it, and I've been doing it for 30 years or whatever. I like to be at the mixes and I like to participate in that whole process. One interesting thing I noticed when I was living in Los Angeles, I was going to the mix on this show at Sony that I was doing. I made a comment about the sound effects. You don't do that, man. Stay in your fucking lane. We don't need you talking about sound effects. It was funny. Anyway, back to what you were asking. So I would show up at these mixes, and that was very helpful and useful because there's a pretty substantial overlap between what's known as sound design and a synth score. My score for this show was all synths. As a result, I wound up sending specific cues to the sound designer, and which was great because he could avoid harmonic clashes. He could avoid harmonic clashes and just get an idea where I was going with the score, and he could fill in the spots without actually fighting what I was doing. And we're mixing in Atmos, which is sort of the standard delivery now. And I know that because I'm in a new studio, you know, I built a studio in this new house, and my place in LA, I had dialed in and was very, very confident about what I did in there would sound great on TV, which it did. But I wasn't so sure about this. So I also wanted to go to the mixes to,
oh, right,
to get tactile feedback about, so what's happening in the bottom end here. Yep. And I delivered a really bottom end heavy score, like really a lot of low end information. And I go in and I talk, I say, so there's a lot of low hertz in this. In my score. And the mixer goes, yeah, we're going to add more.
Oh, wow.
And I went, what? Yeah, we're in Atmos, man. We got a lot of room down there.
Oh, wow. That's cool. Well, that's fascinating, man. It's so interesting. It's a world that, you know, I've done my experience with TV and film stuff has always just been, you know, being asked to do things like for a session as part of it, but I've never been the composer on a show to that extent. So it's a process I don't know anything about. It's really interesting.
Yeah. But you've written tons of songs and you've
sure,
written lots
yeah.
of music. Yeah.
Yeah, and I've been involved in the shows, but I've always had the buffer of the composer being the guy that's dealing with all this shit, and I'm just like doing a guitar part. So it's
yeah.
really
yeah. And it's an interesting thing, you know, because I mean, sometimes I think that the actual writing of the music is sort of the easiest part of the job. I mean,
yeah,
and that's not always the case, but you wind up. You're a storyteller like everyone else is a storyteller, and you're trying to interpret someone's vision. So there's a lot of, you know, interpretation and deciphering and translation going on. And I remember often you're in a situation where you're working with someone and they go, oh, I don't know the musical term for it. I said, no, it's not your job to know the musical term.
Right.
Please don't talk crescendo with me. You know, tell me what you want to feel. And let me see if I can make that happen. And so you just take all that pressure off people that are feeling insecure about music.
Yep.
And having said that, I did a show with a guy. It was a sniper show. God, it was really, really fun to do. And the writer was a musician, a jazz musician. And so we're sitting at the mix and we start talking about jazz music and we're like, we have the exact same taste. We know the same guys and blah, blah, blah. And so when he made a musical comment, you know, so this could be more this or that. I go, yeah, yeah, yeah. We can definitely do that. You know, so.
But that's rare.
Yeah, it is. However, there's a lot of, you know, polymaths out there, people that do so many different things and do them well.
So tell me a bit about your background and like how you got into this racket in the first place. Cause like at some point, you know, things must have shifted for you where you suddenly saw like this film thing as like a viable career option. But up until that point, you were road dogging it in a blues band.
Yeah.
So tell me a bit about your life at that point. And like, were you what was your life like as a touring musician? Were you happy in that situation or was it fucking crazy or like what was going on?
I was a jazz guy in high school and for this 3 months of college that I went to. And, and I got was playing in all the, you know, in every sort of available jazz outlet that I could get my hands on in Vancouver, which was oddly, there was a lot of them back then. This is in the late 70s, early 80s. And I applied for and received a Canada Council grant to go study in New York for a year. Back then they gave you like more money than I made the year before to go and, you know, as a musician. Yeah. And so I went to New York, but my girlfriend at the time was pregnant. So I brought her with me and I studied with Dave Liebman and Bob Berg when I was there.
Wow. So just like deep saxophone training.
And jazz, yeah. You know.
And jazz training, yeah.
And practice my ass off. But I mean, that's sort of the reason I dropped out of college. I was practicing 8 hours a day or studying, you know, and then I go to college and suddenly I'm lucky if I get 90 minutes of practicing and I just went, this is not going to work, you know?
Yeah.
So
cramping my style.
Yeah. You know, I can't do that anyway. So we came back from New York to have our son and, just before I went to New York, I landed the gig with Powder. That's right.
Okay, so this is Powder Blues. They were, at the time, like sort of a blues band, but they had some huge sort of pop, crossover pop rock hits on the radio. I'm just telling people for the background that don't know who the Powder Blues are. They were, it was a big deal in the early 80s, that band, right?
Yeah.
So were they already at that stage, or were they just starting out, or what was, where were they at?
They'd already had like big hits.
Yeah.
They played at Montreux Jazz Festival. They were big. And it was 1984 that I joined the band. Powder started, I think, in 79, maybe a little earlier, and had quite a bit of success.
Yeah.
Bruce Allen, I believe, was repping them at one point.
Was he really? Yeah.
Anyhow, so it had really, you know, it was a major get for me when I landed that job.
Were you looking for it, or did it just come out of the blue?
You're always looking for work when you're a freelance.
Yeah.
Player. It came out of Bill Clark, the trumpet player, had joined the band, and Dave Woodward, the saxophone player, was taking a break. And because the other thing too is I was a jazz guy, but I was also the jazz guy who would play in at the American with Gordy Walker and Danny Tripper. And like, I would do that stuff. And I also had a bit of a long time and very fruitful relationship with a guy named Gary Stevens, who originally from Wichita, and he lived up in Vancouver. And he kind of did a Ray Charles, James Brown, R&B country thing. He played a B3, and I joined that band. That was my first full-time band when I was 18 years old or something. And back then, when you had a house gig, it was 2 or 3 weeks, 6 or 7 nights a week.
So you get good.
Well, yeah, and you'd make a lot of, you know, there's a lot of time to make mistakes. Right. And anyhow, so I had done that, and all my jazz friends were sort of sneering at me because I'm out there playing R&B, but I'm also paying the rent and that sort of thing. That was important to me for some reason.
Sure. How busy were they at that time? Were they touring a lot?
Very busy. For example, that first year, my son was born. We did 180 shows. I missed his first steps, his first words.
Wow.
I paid the rent, but I missed all the milestones, right?
Yeah.
But when I was home, and I was with him, and that was great. And then my wife got pregnant again immediately, and we had a daughter. And I kind of realized that even though I was in this great band, if I was going to have a family, I wanted to participate. And I had to figure out a way, what can I do that will let me stay at home? I'd always loved movies and TV shows and the soundtracks to them, but I had really done nothing serious.
So you managed to kind of juggle the jazz and the R&B stuff?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was really active in the jazz thing and wrote a bunch of tunes for that band. And so then as I'm trying to sort out how to make a living, I'd moved into a co-op with my young family. And one of the other co-op people was Danny Antonucci.
Oh.
Now you see how this is all happening. And at that time, he had two kids about my kid's age, and he had vertical hair and wore leather and sneered and smoked and wore Dayton's, you know, and stomped around. And
what was he doing at that time? Like, what was his gig?
Animating.
He was
working at International Rocket Ship.
What was International Rocket Ship?
Oh, there was a guy named Marv Newland who did a short film, probably most famous for his short film, Bambi Meets Godzilla. Have you ever seen it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that was one of his big, it was hilarious, man.
Oh, man.
Anyhow,
yeah.
So he was originally from California, I think. And he'd relocated up to Vancouver and sort of collected this renegade, you know, ragtag band of animators to make these short films and also do commercial work. Danny was in that group. And so Danny said to me, we were kind of like, I was the long-haired hippie with the war, you know, was playing jazz saxophone. And he was the punk wearing a leather jacket and stomping around and kind of scaring people just by looking at them. But we both had these toddler kids, right? You know, and so, so one day we wound up, we'd gotten kind of friendly, you know, nodding acquaintances, and I lived downstairs and he lived in the apartment above me. And so we kind of said, come on over. And so either I went to his or he went to mine, and I look at his record. We look at our record collections and go, oh, fuck, we like the same shit. He's got Frank Sinatra, he's got Ornette Coleman, he's got, you know, he's, and then, kind of, you know, George Jones, a bunch of great music. I didn't have quite the same punk collection as he had, but, you know, but he had, we talked the other day about his very eclectic and expansive musical taste. And so we sat around drinking whiskey, listening to Frank, and became very close friends. And he said, so what do you want to do anyhow? And I said, I don't know. I mean, I'm writing. I'd be into getting into scores. And he says, so let me introduce you to Marv. So I went to Rocket Ship, and Marv was a huge jazz fan. And so that was handy. He knew who I was. And we wound up doing a bunch of projects together.
What was the first thing you did with them?
Gosh, you know, that's a great question. I honestly cannot remember, but a very early thing that I did with them was a show called Deadly Deposits for the NFB.
Okay.
I did the score and all the sound effects because I really loved sound effects. I thought the sound effects and music were, there was no reason to separate the two things.
Oh, interesting.
I realized that the reason was because no one person could do it at all.
Yeah.
You know, and stay alive. But yeah, so I did the sound effects and mixed it. No, I didn't mix it. I did the sound effects and the music.
What was that composed of?
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Was that, like, were you composing for a jazz?
I did. Well, this was group? this was a noir kind of thing, right?
Okay.
So I did kind of a Bernard Herrmann-y kind of sounding. And so the animator on it was Jay Faulkner, who I'd mentioned already. And the producer was Dennis Heaton, who is the same guy that I'm doing these Netflix shows with.
Wow. You know, okay. So there, yeah.
It's one of our first projects together. And we are very close friends, and we've just hung out over the 30 years, you know, ever possible. When he goes to LA, he would come and stay with me. And now we're neighbors here on Salt Spring, which is great.
Amazing. You mentioned Bernard Herrmann. Had you also gone deep into that era of film scoring?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, okay. I approached film scoring the same way I approached improvising and jazz. I transcribed and then learned it, you know, put it through 12 keys. Orchestration is a little different. You want to keep it in the key that it sounds good in, but there's different ways of doing it. So that's what I did, is I sat down and transcribed film scores.
Wow, cool.
It's not quite the same as a Coltrane solo, but the principles are the same, you know?
Uh-huh. Were there any big standouts for you of ones in particular that were so influential just from actually sitting down and figuring out what was going on in them?
Well, I mean, one of my favorite composers is Jerry Fielding, and he's famous for his work with Clint Eastwood, but also he did all the Peckinpah films.
Okay.
Most of them. And he was just I didn't know this when I was attracted to his music, but he was a jazz guy. And he had a Vegas band. He got blacklisted he was a film composer in Hollywood, got blacklisted for un-American activities and wound up running a band in Vegas. And then Otto Preminger brought him back in the 60s to do Advice and Consent. And sort of like flip the bird to the, you know, he was sort of one of the guys who said, this guy is not a communist, you know, like the score to Straw Dogs. There's an opening sequence where it's kind of a brass chorale. And then at the end of the brass chorale, you know, we get this montage of stuff going on in this little English village. And then there's these church bells that happen. And the brass chorale and the church bells are actually playing the same thing. And it was just so stunning. Anyway, Jerry Fielding was a huge influence. Of course, in those days, Jerry Goldsmith, you know, you can't really hear it. It doesn't get better than that.
He was everywhere. Yeah.
And Nino Rota, all of the Italian stuff. You know, he did The Godfather, but he did all the Fellini movies too. And
right.
Yeah, he's
a master.
And just so whimsical and different. And his heart was just like everything was just infused with heart, you know, and that's sort of, I think that's really what I try to do is get.
Yeah, that's what comes through to me and the stuff that I hear of what you do and the stuff that I've been around for sure. When you started working with Antonucci and all those guys, did it escalate to a point where all these guys are coming up with all these crazy animations and you were doing a lot of soundtrack work for them, or was it just pretty sporadic in the early days?
Well, I mean, it was job by job. You know, we did some Converse All-Star commercials and we did some work for MTV and on the work of MTV. MTV was just happening in those days and they had just done Beavis and Butthead. And so animation was enjoying this kind of like surge of popularity.
Right.
And they had this bright idea to take the bad boy of animation, Danny, who had done a show called Lupo the Butcher. Have you seen Lupo?
Sure. Yeah. Cause I used to see those festivals of short animation. That was my first experience with him.
Spike and Mike's festival. Yeah. So anyhow, we were doing these shorts, MTV got the idea that animation was their new cash cow. So they hired Danny to do a series that was based on MTV Happy Birthday MTV ID that we did, where there's basically this guy is sitting on the toilet grunting one out. The veins are sticking out. It's just like there were 15, I think 10 or 15 second spots. And he's sitting on the toilet. And the end of it, you hear this plop and the camera pulls back and there's a turd shaped like MTV. And it says, Happy Birthday, MTV. And they loved it. So they said, make us a show like this. So he made a show called The Brothers Grunt.
Right. Did you work on that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think we did 70 episodes. So we did a bunch of episodes of that. And it was really, really out there. There wasn't a lot of, how did we do it? Yeah, that was all I recorded. I wrote a bunch of themes and then I recorded a bunch of bed tracks with musicians in different keys and different tempos that I would then use as sort of a basis. And I'd edit together sort of the comping. And then I would play whatever. I'd play like the guitar or the saxophone or the flute, whatever instruments I could get my hands on. And I'd play that over top of it for the melody material. So I had this basic library of vamps and, you know, themes. And then I'd play live instruments over top of it and edit it all together in Pro Tools, which back then was Sound Designer.
Yeah, right.
Was it? Yeah.
So this is like early 90s. Is that when that was going on?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The big problem with that is that they had Beavis and Butthead on for an hour. Was it every night? Anyway,
oh my God,
it was an hour from 7 to 8. And when they made the Brothers Grunt, rather than just put it on from 8 to 8:30, they took a half hour out of Beavis and Butthead and put Brothers Grunt in. So then all the Beavis and Butthead fans were pissed off because they're losing a half hour of their show. And this was a challenging show. There was no dialogue. There's one character who spoke and the rest
really
just ran around and grunted.
Oh shit.
It was really, really funny.
I've not seen that show. I got to check it out.
Oh, it's in the far reaches, the furthest corners of the internet. You can scrape one or two of them up. But anyhow, so that
just lasted for like one season or something?
Yes. I can't remember how long it took us to do it. But interestingly, because I was doing that and I was attending the mixes at Sharp Sound in North Vancouver, and I was running my Pro Tools rig on the stage and cutting and doing stuff on the stage, Paul Sharp, the owner of Sharp Sound, had just started doing a show called The Outer Limits, an anthology show. And so I saw Paul, you know, every time I was up there mixing and blah, blah, blah. And in fact, that's also the facility that we mixed Deadly Deposits at. So anyhow, they do the first season of Outer Limits for MGM and there's lots of fixes on the stage. Because the picture's changed. Remember I talked about that locked picture that keeps changing.
Yeah, yeah.
So the composers were all in LA and they're sending their stuff up, but the picture's changed since they've written it. So it has to get fixed on the stage and nobody at Sharp at that time was really familiar with Pro Tools, and they were wasting a lot of time on the stage with the big second hand ticking away hundreds at a second, you know. And so he suggested, he goes, "Hey, you know, they picked up Outer Limits for season two. We wasted so much time on the stage last year. Why don't you talk to this guy and tell him you're available to music edit if you want to do it." And I thought, oh, I don't want to fucking music edit, but sure. And because no one else was really doing it at the time up in Vancouver. Wow. And so I contacted the post-production supervisor and cut a deal with him. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the best things I ever did, because I got to hear these scores from the best writers in LA. Like,
who is composing that score?
Oh man, there was John Van Tongeren was doing it.
Okay.
You know, Mark Mancina did some, like, big guys.
Heavy hitters.
Yeah. A lot of guys, you know the names and you go, wow, this is great. And then I would get like eight tracks. I'd get DATs with.
And that was your gig on that show, was to be the music editor.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I would be, I would basically receive the scores, conform it to the picture if necessary, put in the title sequence and the bumpers in and out of commercials, and cut the blacks. And sometimes it had to be sewn together. Did a lot of that kind of stuff. And then the best part of it was also sometimes I'd be in on the spotting sessions. So I'd get to watch, a seasoned composer mm-hmm. sit down with a seasoned producer and discuss the music on a show. And so I learned
right.
what are the good questions, what are the questions not to ask, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was great.
So did you continue doing music editing, or was that just like a one-off thing that just you did for...
I did a bunch of it, and I kind of got a reputation for doing it, and I got more jobs, and I got too busy to... I couldn't do them all. So I'd say, yeah, okay, I'll do this job. And then I would buy another Pro Tools rig and train someone else to do it.
That's sort of what Danny was doing for you at MX, right?
Exactly what Danny was doing. But that's how I met Sean.
Okay.
Is because I had a guy doing a show for me. I've got a composing career going, right? So
yeah.
I'm doing these animated shows, and I'm starting to do documentaries with a company called Paperny. And this is back in the days with Paperny, they didn't use temp score. So basically you got a documentary and you got to invent the sound of the show. And that was really cool. Useful for me as a composer. I called him up, said, "Hey, I got this thing and it pays this. And if you're interested, maybe we can talk about it." He came out, Sean, he said, "Bing, yeah, man, yeah. I'm here." You know, Sean was on a little bit before the Edge started. He would have been mid 90s, maybe 97, 98. And
because we made, I was making records with him up until 98 at Maximum, the place they had on 12th and Arbutus.
Yeah, which was the old Blue Wave, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it was kind of like all this stuff was happening. We had like, I want to say 6 or 7 American TV series that we were
amazing
music editing on.
So that really snowballed then. The music editing thing really sort of took on a life of its own.
It did. Yeah. So I'd buy another Pro Tools rig and train someone to run it and you know, and do that sort of thing and manage everything. And my girlfriend at the time, her father, he was watching this whole thing happen, and he goes, "You know, you're really busy. Have you ever thought of like operating your own facility? You know, because I've got Pro Tools rigs in people's spare bedrooms. You know,
right? Yeah,
it's not that sexy, you know." And he goes, "What kind of work do you have coming up?" And I describe it all to him. He was a banker, and he looked at the whole thing. He says, "Listen, man, I think there's an opportunity for you to make some pretty good money here, and I want to back you." And I said, "What?" And he says, "Yeah, let's talk about building a studio." So with his encouragement and with his cash, I went out and found the warehouse space at 7th in Quebec?
7th, I think, yeah.
1,500 square feet. And it was a photography studio before that. So moved in, and we spent $150,000 building the rooms.
I remember going in when it was being built.
Yeah. So we spent a fair chunk of change, and I put new computers and new everything. And then we had a machine room. It was a pretty sexy little setup.
Yeah, it was good.
And a place we could bring the clients.
Totally.
Instead of like someone's basement apartment.
Yeah. Yeah.
And And then there was my composing suite, the corner office. And then built the surround room for Sean. And that was great. So we, you know, we could do surround mixes, which weren't that prominent, but that was the writing on the wall. I mean,
yeah,
we knew it was going to be there. So we sort of planned accordingly. And I told you yesterday that, you know, we cut the ribbon on in August of 2001. And on, you know, literally 6 weeks later or 4 weeks later, the 9/11 attacks happened and no one was getting on a plane to come to do TV in Canada for that year. So it was like everything was going great until then and it all just shut down.
Oh, man.
So, you know, sitting there sucking wind. But I was doing the Eds, and the Eds really financed MX for the most part.
We did talk about that yesterday, but just as a brief aside. So the Eds was Ed, and Eddie. That was Antonucci coming back at you saying, I've got this crazy ass project.
Yes.
And I mean, that turned out into a huge thing. It's still got fans all over the world. Just give me a quick rundown on sort of how that started and how that happened and just the general aesthetic of it.
Yeah, we did the Brothers Grunt, and then Danny pitched a show or did Cartoon Network somehow. I think Danny created a show, pitched it around, Cartoon Network bought it. And that would have been 97, 98 kind of thing.
Yeah.
We premiered in 99, the first episode. And it takes a year or two to get this stuff up off the ground.
Yeah.
Danny asked me to score it for him. It would be different from the Brothers Grunt. There was money for live players. Danny does not like samples or anything like that. It's always got to be live. So,
which is super cool and fun for you.
It's fantastic. As long as the money's there and the money was there.
Right. Yeah.
That was literally the last show with old school money that I did.
Interesting.
And it lasted for 10 years, which was nice.
The idea was like for you to go in and you basically scored, there was music under almost every minute of action in that show, right? It was like wall to wall music almost.
Pretty much. Yeah. There were pauses, but it was from the left top corner to the right bottom corner.
And amazingly to me, I saw you do this, like you would write out the score on paper with your own handwriting. Well, and in Vancouver every 2 weeks, you would have these sessions and bring in all these heavy cats and play the shit down. And basically like it just was all live. And I remember Sean was recording it and it wasn't even multi-tracked. It was just recorded to two-track. I do remember that even, right?
No, we did multi-track.
Oh, you did? Okay.
We did, but I mean, we were also, everything is always in record. Everything's radio ready, basically. That we learned that lesson. You only learn that one once.
Right,
you
know, right.
When they do the perfect first take and you think you're just getting levels, you know?
Yeah. So you would do these sessions for the Eds and essentially the band would just run the entire show down, right? Like you were tracking live.
Yeah.
Everyone's a heavy reader.
Yeah.
They're funny. They're crazy. What was the direction that you were given? Like what were the hallmarks for you to compose to with that show?
Well, you know, the old Louis Prima's band bus and Duke Ellington's band bus have a head-on collision in the desert one night. And the Ed's band is the survivors, you know. But if it could be that, that's what I was hoping for. And it had to be funny, but it had to drive. And that's another show where there's themes for characters, and then sometimes a situation would come up. For example, when you played the slide. You know, when you played the slide guitar, but for the most part, it was all that same trumpet, trombone, tenor, piano, bass, and drums.
Right.
Yeah. Danny didn't like anything that sounded slick. He wanted to see that.
It had to be rough around the edges. And how long would it take you to do one show, handwritten, composed, written, and up to the point where the band sits down with it? I also remember you like scribbling out like last minute.
Oh yeah,
changes and new parts like right until I saw some of those sessions and and you were writing right up till the last second.
Oh, and well past it. Yeah, the old saying that the ink's not dry is it's quite a thing. And to answer the question, at the beginning, of course, when you're trying to figure out how it's going to work,
yeah,
and everyone's trying to figure it out. Sean was the engineer on all that stuff for the most part.
Yeah.
Shelly became the engineer when Shelly, you know, it took every bit of those 2 weeks to get it done. you know, from the spotting to the writing to the...
Were you doing demos and like temping it out and playing it to Antonucci before you got in with the band?
For the theme, yes. I'm talking about the show theme. But that was kind of like one demo. If I recall, it's like he said, I want it a little bit. He goes, you know, Big Noise from Winnetka? And I go, yeah. And he said, I want something like that. So I did a thing and he whistled it and we were off to the races, you know.
Amazing. Yeah.
That was, I remember that was Jerry Adolph playing drums on that. Like this, the craziest two-handed shuffle you could ever imagine. God, he's
the man.
Yeah.
Yep.
So with all this stuff, you get better at it. You develop systems. Yep. And I think I mentioned, you know, by the end of it, we got that stuff done in a week. You know, but it was a vertical week. I mean, you didn't do much sleeping. I loved it.
And definitely like nothing's ever been like that since and probably never will, right? Like that just doesn't really exist. I mean, I guess it could happen again, but that's sort of like a perfect storm of,
yeah,
of the industry at the time was able to handle that. And that kind of animation is like so crazy and old school in a way.
Yes, absolutely. And speaking of old, I think it was the last hand-painted animated show ever. It and
amazing
and The Simpsons. And that was one of the things that sort of made things crunchy was that, you know, they do the animation in Korea and then send it over, and then Fixes had to go back to Korea and send them, and was like, wow. And you know, meanwhile, here's your delivery, and it just gets crunched and crunched and crunched, and then you're fitting the scoring in. And, yeah. And to be fair, the sound effects guys had to do it too, and that's really hard. And the sound effects were a big part of that show too. But by the end, we were doing, like I said, I could get that show written and orchestrated. Like basically what, if I'm remembering correctly, I basically wrote into the sequencer with piano, bass, and just a drum sound, like a hi-hat. And then I'd go through the whole show, get it the way I wanted it, and then go back and take out the manuscript and then orchestrate it.
So awesome.
It'd take a couple of days to get it written, vertical days, and a couple of days to orchestrate it. And then we'd go into the studio and record it in a day. Yeah. Sean would edit it together,
yeah,
and do whatever fixes were required. And then I would deliver it as a two-track to the stage, yeah, not stems.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So that show lasted for a good 10 years.
Yeah, it was on the air for 10 years. We had, was longer than that actually, but we worked on it for 10 years.
Amazing.
At first, you get these calendars and with the schedule, and then there's a little field on the calendar that says, you know, how many days over or under schedule you are. And I remember seeing the last time they actually put that feature on the calendar, it was 495 days over. So, okay, we don't need that field on the calendar anymore. Just ignore that.
No doubt. Oh my God. Just one last thing that maybe you could talk about a little bit is like the transition for you from when you decided to shut down MX, your place that was obviously going pretty bananas in Vancouver. And what was that process like for you deciding like, I'm going to make this move? Were you at a certain point in your success where you felt like it was essential, or did you just want to change, or what was going on with you then?
Yeah, that would have been in 2005. I moved to Los Angeles.
Okay.
And so we would start going down there quite a bit, and I was focusing my attention on it because I just thought it's the center of the universe for what it is that we're doing.
Sure.
I want to know what's going on. Like, Sean and I went to this state of the music convention at the SCL, the Society of Composers and Lyricists. I think it was 2000 or 2001 or something like that. And so there was sort of this thing about a facility going on and going down and sort of connecting with the scene in LA. And I just love Los Angeles. I just love it. I love it. Everything about it. You know, I love the city and the scene and the weather and the people. It's fantastic. And so in 2005, my son had already moved out of the house, and my daughter had just graduated high school and was going to university in Montreal. She went to Concordia to study English. Don't know why, but that's where she went. So she went in September and I went, fuck it, I'm out of here.
Wow.
And rented, at that time I was doing The Ed still and The Dead Zone with Sean was doing that with me, and Wildfire was, we had just gotten Wildfire season two because the original composer, Jay Gruska, wanted a pay bump and they weren't going to give it to him. So, you know, you know, the mercenaries come in.
Right. Did you have to like wrangle your way out of your situation in Vancouver? I don't remember how that went.
I left it running. I left it with Sean.
Oh, okay.
You know, and Sean, okay. And by this time, Natasha Dupre had, we'd hired Natasha and sort of said, you know, we need to get into music supervision. And so she came across, I think she was working at Network or something like that before. Yeah. And we just basically said, there's this opportunity, are you in? And she said, yeah, fuck, I'm in. And so she was great, still is great. Yeah. In fact, I work with her on most of the shows that I do still to this day.
Cool.
And so I went down there, left MX running, and that was hard and didn't really work out. The pesky economic downturn happened. That's really what happened.
Did you still have the place like up until?
Yes.
When did the place vaporize?
I think I sold it in 2009, 2008.
Oh, wow. That long.
Yeah. Okay. I got killed.
Yeah.
You know, because I'd spent a lot of money building it and I sold it.
Yeah. For,
and it's funny because I did a Hallmark movie that was mixing there and I went in and saw my old studio. It was great. They tarted it up. It was looking really good and it sounded great. And I thought, oh, yeah, okay, this is nice.
Wow. Cool.
So that was sort of the transition and I tried to keep MX going. And then eventually I couldn't as a company, there just wasn't the work to support it. So, Natasha and I agreed that she should move on to greener pastures. And so she, I think that's when she went to work for Feldman. And then I rented the suites out on a kind of like prorated, but it didn't work out well.
Right.
It was hard.
Yeah.
And I was busy in LA and I couldn't put the time in to sort of, you know, when the cat's away, the mice will
totally
play. And I don't think anyone, you know, played or anything. It's just, you need a guiding force. And I guess I was that, you know, me and Sean were that. And then when neither one of us was there, it just kind of like floundered.
Well, it's been a journey and now you're in Salt Spring for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
And like, are you still getting stuff coming in on a regular basis where you feel like it's, you can sort of kick back now, or is it still, are you still like scrambling for work where you have to, or like,
well, you know, you're the life of a freelance
guy. Well, tell me about it.
You know exactly what it's like. I don't want to stop working. I love working. I love what I do. Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, Danny actually has a show that he's developing now.
Oh yeah.
I actually did a bunch,
back to square one.
Yeah. I did a bunch of demos for him.
Wow.
It's hilarious. And typically, and so, yeah, Danny feels like it would be nice to do one more show. So it'd be great if that happened. We'll see what happens with the Imperfects. I love working with Dennis too. And I really like what we've come up with, you know, for a sound on the show. For me, it's really fun because, like I say, a lot of my stuff is sort of that MIDI orchestra thing. And this was all synth and really fun to sort of play with that palette.
Yeah.
I love what I do. I'm lucky to be doing it.
Clearly. Well, thanks, man. I really appreciate you telling me some of the,
it was a nice
some of the
visit.
Ins and outs.
We got to do it with a cocktail next time.
I know. It's been too long.
Love you, man.
All right, man.
Talk
love you too.
Bye.
See ya. Oh yeah, thanks for listening, everybody. That was my conversation with Patrick Caird. I hope you enjoyed it. I will be back in a couple weeks for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. We'll see you then. Music Makers and Soul Shakers is produced at the Hen House Studio in Nashville, Tennessee by Steve Dawson. Please remember to subscribe to the show and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. You can find more info on this episode, including show notes and an audio playlist at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Thanks again to our amazing sponsors this season, Ear Trumpet Labs, Union Tube and Transistor, Black Mountain Picks, Isotope, and Spectra 1964. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.